Homodeus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. Chapter 10, The Ocean of Consciousness. The new religions are unlikely to emerge from the caves of Afghanistan or from the madrasas of the Middle East. Rather, they will emerge from research laboratories, just as socialism took over the world by promising salvation through steam and electricity. So in the coming decades, new techno-religions may conquer the world by promising salvation through algorithms and genes. Despite all the talk of radical Islam and Christian fundamentalism, the most interesting place in the world from a religious perspective is not the Islamic State or the Bible Belt, but Silicon Valley. That's where high-tech gurus are brewing for us brave new religions that have little to do with God and everything to do with technology. They promise all the old prizes, happiness, peace, prosperity, and even eternal life, but here on earth with the help of technology, rather than after death with the help of celestial beings. These new techno-religions can be divided into two main types, techno-humanism and data religion. Data religion argues that humans have completed their cosmic task, and they should now pass the torch onto entirely new kinds of entities. We will discuss the dreams and nightmares of data religion in the next chapter. This chapter is dedicated to the more conservative creed of techno-humanism, which still sees humans as the apex of creation and clings to many traditional humanist values. Techno-humanism agrees that Homo sapiens, as we know it, has run its historical course and will no longer be relevant in the future, but concludes that we should therefore use technology in order to create Homo Deus, a much superior human model. Homo Deus will retain some essential human features, but will also enjoy upgraded physical and mental abilities that will enable it to hold its own even against the most sophisticated non-conscious algorithms. Since intelligence is decoupling from consciousness, and since non-conscious intelligence is developing at breakneck speed, humans must actively upgrade their minds if they want to stay in the game. 70,000 years ago, the cognitive revolution transformed the sapiens mind, thereby turning an insignificant African ape into the ruler of the world. The improved sapiens mind suddenly had access to the vast intersubjective realm, which enabled us to create gods and corporations, to build cities and empires, to invent writing and money, and eventually to split the atom and reach the moon. As far as we know, this earth-shattering revolution resulted from a few small changes in the sapiens' DNA and a slight rewriting of the sapiens' brain. If so, says techno-humanism, maybe a few additional changes to our genome and another rewiring of our brain will suffice for launching a second cognitive revolution. The mental renovations of the first cognitive revolution gave Homo sapiens access to the intersubjective realm and turned us into the rulers of the planet. A second cognitive revolution might give Homo Deus access to unimaginable new realms and turn us into the lords of the galaxy. This idea is an updated variant on the old dreams of evolutionary humanism, which already a century ago called for the creation of superhumans. However, whereas Hitler and his ilk planned to create superhumans by means of selective breeding and ethnic cleansing, 21st century techno-humanism hopes to reach the goal far more peacefully with the help of genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and brain-computer interfaces. Techno-humanism seeks to upgrade the human mind and give us access to unknown experiences and unfamiliar states of consciousness. However, revamping the human mind is an extremely complex and dangerous undertaking. As we saw in Chapter 3, we don't really understand the mind. We don't know how minds emerge or what their function is. Through trial and error, we learn how to engineer mental states, but we seldom comprehend the full implication of such manipulations. Worse yet, since we are unfamiliar with the full spectrum of mental states, we don't know what mental aims to set ourselves. We are akin to the inhabitants of a small isolated island who have just invented the first boat and are about to set sail without a map or even a destination. Indeed, we are in a somewhat worse condition. The inhabitants of our imaginary island at least know that they occupy just a small space within a large and mysterious sea. We fail to appreciate that we are living on a tiny island of consciousness within the giant ocean of alien mental states. Just as the spectrums of light and sound are far larger than what we humans can see and hear, so the spectrum of mental states is far larger than what the average human is aware of. We can see lights in wavelengths of between 400 and 700 nanometers only. Above this small principality of human vision extend the unseen but vast realms of infrared, microwaves, and radio waves, and below it lie the dark kingdoms of ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays. Similarly, the spectrum of possible mental states may be infinite, but science has studied only two tiny sections of it, the subnormative and the weird. For more than a century, psychologists and biologists have conducted extensive research on people suffering from various psychiatric disorders and mental diseases. Consequently, today we have a very detailed, though far from perfect, map of the subnormative mental spectrum. Simultaneously, scientists have studied the mental states of people considered to be healthy and normative. However, most scientific research about the human mind and the human experience has been conducted on people from Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, i.e. weird, societies, who do not constitute a representative sample of humanity. The study of the human mind has so far assumed that Homo sapiens is a Homo Simpson. In a groundbreaking 2010 study, Joseph Henrich, Stephen Heiner, and Ara Nozanayan systematically surveyed all the papers published between 2003 and 2007 in leading scientific journals belonging to six different subfields of psychology. The study found that though the papers often make broad claims about the human mind, most of them base their findings on exclusively weird samples, W-E-R-D, samples. For example, in papers published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, arguably the most important journal in the subfield of social psychology, 96% of the sample individuals were weird, and 68% were Americans. Moreover, 67% of American subjects and 80% of the non-American subjects were psychology students. In other words, more than two-thirds of the individuals sampled for papers published in this prestigious journal were psychology students in Western universities. Henrich, Heiner, and Nurendayan half-jokingly suggested that the journal change its name to the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology of American Psychology Students. Psychology students star in many of the studies because their professors oblige them to take part in experiments. If I'm a psychology professor at Harvard, it is much easier for me to conduct experiments on my own students than on the residents of a crime-ridden New York slum, not to mention traveling to Namibia and conducting experiments on hunter-gatherers in the Kalahari Desert. However, it may well be that New York slum dwellers and Kalahari hunter-gatherers experience mental states which we will never discover by forcing Harvard psychology students to answer long questionnaires or stick their heads into fMRI scanners. Even if we travel all over the world and study each and every community, we would still cover only a very small, limited part of the sapiens mental spectrum. Nowadays, all humans have been touched by modernity, and we are all members of a single global village. The Kalahari foragers are somewhat less modern than Harvard psychology students. They are not a time capsule from our distant past. They too have been influenced by Christian missionaries, European traders, wealthy ecotourists, and inquisitive anthropologists. The joke is that in the Kalahari Desert, the typical hunter-gatherer band consists of 20 hunters, 20 gatherers, and 50 anthropologists. Before the emergence of the global village, the planet was a galaxy of isolated human cultures, which might have fostered mental states that are now extinct. Different socio-economic realities and daily routines nurtured different states of consciousness. Who could gauge the minds of Stone Age mammoth hunters, Neolithic farmers, or Kamakura samurais? Moreover, many pre-modern cultures believed in the existence of superior states of consciousness, which people might access using meditation, drugs, or rituals. Shamans, monks, and ascetics systematically explored the mysterious lands of mind and came back laden with breathtaking stories. They told of unfamiliar states of supreme tranquility, extreme sharpness, and matchless sensitivity. They told of the mind expanding to infinity or dissolving into emptiness. The humanist revolution caused modern Western culture to lose faith and interest in superior mental states and to sanctify the mundane experiences of the average Joe. Modern Western culture is therefore unique in lacking a special class of people who seek to experience extraordinary mental states. It believes anyone attempting to do so is a drug addict, mental patient, or charlatan. Consequently, though we have a detailed map of the mental landscape of Harvard psychology students, we know far less about the mental landscapes of Native American shamans, Buddhist monks, or Sufi mystics. And that is just the sapient's mind. 50,000 years ago, we shared this planet with our Neanderthal cousins. They did not launch spaceships, build pyramids, or establish empires. They obviously had very different mental abilities and lacked many of our talents. Nevertheless, they had bigger brains than us sapiens. What exactly did they do with all those neurons? We have absolutely no idea. But they might well have had many mental states that no sapiens had ever experienced. Yet even if we take into account all human species that ever existed, that would still not exhaust the mental spectrum. Other animals probably have experiences that we humans can barely imagine. Bats, for example, experience the world through echolocation. They emit a very rapid stream of high-frequency calls well beyond the range of the human ear. They then detect and interpret the returning echoes to build a picture of the world. That picture is so detailed and accurate that the bats can fly quickly between trees and buildings, chase and capture moths and mosquitoes, and all the time evade owls and other predators. The bats live in a world of echoes. Just as in the human world, every object has a characteristic shape and color, so in the bat world, every object has its echo pattern. A bat can tell the difference between a tasty moth species and a poisonous moth species by the different echoes returning from their slender wings. Some edible moth species try to protect themselves by evolving an echo pattern similar to that of other poisonous species. Other moths have evolved an even more remarkable ability to deflect the waves of the bat radar, so that, like stealth bombers, they fly around without the bat knowing they are there. The world of echolocation is as complex and stormy as a familiar world of sound and sight, but we are completely oblivious to it. One of the most important articles about the philosophy of mind is titled, "What is it like to be a bat?" In this 1974 article, the philosopher Thomas Nagel points out that a sapient's mind cannot fathom the subjective world of a bat. We can write all the algorithms we want about the bat body, about bat echolocation systems, and about bat neurons, but it will not tell us how it feels to be a bat. How does it feel to echolocate a moth flapping its wings? Is it similar to seeing it, or is it something completely different? Trying to explain to sapiens how it feels to echolocate a butterfly is probably as pointless as explaining to a blind mole how it feels to see a Caravaggio. It's likely that bats' emotions are also deeply influenced by the centrality of their echolocation sense. For sapiens, love is red, envy is green, and depression is blue. Who knows what echolocations color the love of a female bat to her offspring, or the feelings of a male bat towards his rivals? Bats are not special, of course. They are but one out of countless possible examples. Just as sapiens cannot understand what it's like to be a bat, we have similar difficulties understanding how it feels to be a whale, a tiger, or a pelican. It certainly feels like something, but we don't know like what. Both whales and humans process emotions in a part of the brain called the limbic system, yet the whale limbic system contains an entire additional part which is missing from the human structure. Maybe that part enables whales to experience extremely deep and complex emotions which are alien to us. Whales might also have astounding musical experiences which even Bach and Mozart could not grasp. Whales can hear one another from hundreds of kilometers away, and each whale has a repertoire of characteristic songs that may last for hours and follow very intricate patterns. Every now and then, a whale composes a new hit which other whales throughout the ocean adopt. Scientists routinely record these hits and analyze them with the help of computers, but can any human fathom these musical experiences and tell the difference between a whale Beethoven and a whale Justin Bieber? None of this should surprise us. Sapiens do not rule the world because they have deeper emotions or more complex musical experiences than other animals, so we may be inferior to whales, bats, tigers, and pelicans, at least in some emotional and experiential domains. Beyond the mental spectrum of humans, bats, whales, and all other animals, even vaster and stranger continents may lie in wait. In all probability, there is an infinite variety of mental states that no sapiens, bat, or dinosaur ever experienced in 4 billion years of terrestrial evolution because they did not have the necessary faculties. In the future, however, powerful drugs, genetic engineering, electronic helmets, and direct brain-computer interfaces may open passages to these places. Just as Columbus and Magellan sailed beyond the horizon to explore new islands and unknown continents, so we may one day set sail towards the antipodes of the mind.